Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. So, do you want marketing made simple? Shopify removes the guesswork with built-in tools that help you create, execute, and analyze all your online marketing campaigns. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/income, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/income now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/income. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to another episode of Broadway Nation, the podcast that tells the remarkable story of how immigrant, Jewish, queer, and Black artists invented the Broadway musical and how they changed America in the process. I'm David Armstrong, and this is the second segment in my recent conversation with author Ben West regarding his exceptionally comprehensive new book, The American Musical, Evolution of an Art Form. This book traces the American musical's creative journey from its 19th century beginnings through its 20th century maturation and on to the turn of the 21st century. Along the way, Ben sheds new light on a myriad of shows, authors, directors, and performers, including a host of often overlooked women and African American artists. If you missed the first episode in this series, you may want to go back and catch up on that one before listening to this one. Before I jump in, of course, I want to thank all of our Patron Club members whose generous support helps to make Broadway Nation possible, especially our newest patron, Taryn Darr. If you would like to help support the creation of this podcast, I'll have information at the end of the episode about how you too can become a member. As our previous episode ended, Ben and I were discussing the review form, especially those annual reviews such as the Ziegfeld Follies and Earl Carroll's Vanities. Today, we pick up our conversation with some of the other forms of musical theater that Ben explores in part two of his book, a section that he titles Birth of an Art Form. Here we go.
So anyway, lots of review in the early period. Musical comedy, intimate musical comedy, operetta, which we touched on a little bit, I put in quotes.
And why do you put operetta in quotes?
Because I think the term has taken on a meaning that doesn't represent the shows that are now dubbed operetta. Maytime, for example, is classified as operetta now because it's associated with its composer, Sigmund Romberg. But one of the things I attempt to address in the book is the fact that Sigmund Romberg wasn't confined to one style of entertainment. For example, he wrote Dancing Around. And you have Victor Herbert. I was just watching something and he was identified as America's premier composer of operetta. And some of Victor Herbert's most popular shows were not in the operetta line.
The Red Mill is not really an operetta.
No, Red Mill is not an opera. He wrote a burlesque. He wrote a vaudeville tap called The Songbirds. He wrote a show that predates the Princess musicals called The Only Girl. This is in 1914. It's part of the, it's not necessarily a direct part, but it coincides with the little theater movement that is happening in America. So, I mean, Victor Herbert did not just write operetta. And so this is why I put operetta in quotes to an extent, because it's not really the most appropriate term for some of the shows that have now been filed under that heading.
I think that we just pigeonhole these artists in a way yes. that is not fair to what they were, because we don't know that much about them. But even like Dorothy Donnelly, who you talk about, she wrote musical comedies as well as operettas. And some of them, I mean, are clearly operettas. Rosemary is an operetta. There's no doubt about that. Or The Student Prince. But that's not all they wrote. In the same way, Oscar Hammerstein wrote operettas and wrote other things, but we don't pigeonhole him the same way.
And I think also there's a negative connotation about operetta. For example, you mentioned Rosemary, and whatever one terms it as a style, I think operetta gives the sense of frivolous, grand, classical singing, princes, lavish costumes, stately affair, and love and romance. And so that term, operetta, as it now has come to be understood, minimizes the progressive nature of something like what you just mentioned, Rosemary.
Right, which is a precursor to the great musical plays that will come after it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, yes. That's all why I put operetta in quotes, because it doesn't really define something like Maytime or something like Rosemary. Rosemary in particular, especially for Oscar Hammerstein's trajectory, Rosemary was instrumental.
Talk a little bit about burlesque, because I think that's the most misunderstood, because they're this sort of nouveau burlesque, and you can go to Seattle and there's several burlesque shows running right now, and they're sexy shows. That term didn't mean that, as you said a little while ago, until the 1930s. It might have meant it was sexy, but it wasn't a skin show.
It wasn't striptease.
It wasn't striptease, yeah. Or even particularly in-your-face sexuality.
And I think part of the confusion is because the form is so amorphous. It is also a style. There is burlesque, a style, which is slapstick, travesty, comedy, and that is largely what characterized the form pre-1930s. Not exclusively. There were some seedy places like the Dewey Theater. That's one of the things I had to cut from the book. But the Dewey Theater is fascinating.
Where was that?
Lower Manhattan. I think it was around Union Square. They presented burlesque troupes, but they also did their own burlesque shows. This would have been late 1890s. One of the shows that they did involved a woman going into a lion cage with a real lion, or maybe it was a tiger. It was a lion or a tiger. I can't remember right now. And feigning sexual intercourse with the lion or the tiger. So that was one of the things. And then I found a clipping, I don't know how many weeks or months later, that the tiger had bit her or the lion had bit her during the performance. There were certain venues, but by and large, burlesque as a form was generally a high-class institution. Vaudeville operated in circuits. Vaudeville was a major, major, major institution. Burlesque didn't really even come close to it. Vaudeville operated in bills and you had big time, small time and week to week, etc. We can go into that further if you want. But burlesque operated primarily in wheels. So you had never more really than two wheels operating at the same time. And each wheel would have roughly 30 to 40 theaters and corresponding troops. So everyone moved in the same pattern around the wheel, basically.
And it was a set show. The whole show moved to the next venue.
Exactly
as
right.
As opposed to a vaudeville where the acts moved individually, independently of one another. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a scripted entertainment, which also separates it from vaudeville. The Columbia was the premier institution. They operated for a great number of years, basically presided over this period, and they had a house on Broadway. The Columbia Theater was a Broadway house that played burlesque. And again, this is burlesque of a high-class order before it's associated with striptease.
Which comes in the 1930s, and it sort of infiltrates burlesque to the point where then today we think that's all a burlesque show was.
Oh, I mean, I think, yes, it's become synonymous with burlesque. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about jazz. How does jazz influence the musical? I was just talking to my students yesterday about this. I'm talking about jazz and the show tune happen at the same time, but they're not the same thing. What's your take on jazz and its relationship to Broadway?
Well, it depends. First of all, it depends on your definition of Broadway in terms of that question. I think you mean the musical.
And jazz.
Yeah. First of all, jazz doesn't just happen in 1917. It is evolving over a period of time. And that evolution is largely found in nightclubs and vaudeville.
And let's just highlight that for a moment, because I think one of the things that makes your book different than most other books is that you do include the nightclub world of Times Square, and not just Times Square, but especially Times Square. And I've made this argument myself several times. When you talked about Broadway back then, in the public imagination, it was just as much about those nightclubs, maybe even more so, than it was about the shows in the legitimate theaters. Broadway was this world of Times Square, including hundreds of nightclubs.
A world of entertainment.
A world of entertainment, yeah. Exactly.
They are influencing what is happening on the legitimate stage. The musical that we understand that matures mid-century is not, in its maturation and what it becomes, is not confined exclusively to the legitimate stage. It is vaudeville. It is nightclubs, which you're just talking about. Burlesque. It is vestiges of minstrelsy.
So just to get back to the point you were making, jazz starts to emerge for the first time in New York in these nightclub venues.
Correct. In 1917 specifically, we have the original Dixieland Jazz Band at Rice and Weber's, which is one of the major nightclubs. It is flourishing in these nightclubs. Two of the major figures in the early jazz scene are Paul Whiteman and Vincent Lopez, both of them with roots in nightclubs and vaudeville. Vincent Lopez, he had a jazz orchestra, and they were quite theatrical in nature in how he dramatized the music that the orchestra was playing. So anyway, these two major figures were a major part of nightclubs, vaudeville. Both of them also performed briefly in legit with their orchestra. And then, of course, Paul Whiteman has the concert hall, Rhapsody in Blue concert. And that same year, which is 1924, Vincent Lopez has his own symphonic jazz concert as well. Jazz is really incubated on and closely attached to the musical stage and is immediately embraced in legit and in popular songwriting. All of this is happening on top of each other at the same time, really. And this synthesis of syncopation, blues, ragtime that we call jazz is instrumental in advancing songwriting craft and maturing the popular song, which itself overlapped with the musical stage. Thus, it is so theatrical in the first three decades.
Is it possible to identify the first Broadway shows that include elements of jazz or include jazz music, or the first, again, as you said before, you're wary of anything first, but are there a couple of names that are part of the mix? For example, later we're able to say Bye Bye Birdie probably is the first Broadway show that includes any kind of real rock and roll music in it. What's the equivalent of that for jazz?
Well, it's difficult because jazz is not something that just happens. Again, when you say Broadway, are you meaning legit musical?
I'm talking legit now, yeah. So okay, as opposed to the nightclubs, when does jazz go legit?
I wouldn't say the first, but I do identify shows that are using this new sound. For example, Jim Jam Gems, which we talked about, that's 1920. Sophie Tucker and her Seven Kings of Syncopation go into a show called Hello Alexander, which is 1919. There is a black jazz band that goes into a play in 1917. I can't remember the name of the play. It's by George Hobart. I think it's called What's Your Husband Doing? Again, this idea that Shuffle Along is the first black jazz band on Broadway is false. Sorry, just a side note to debunk that myth. Earl Carroll, before he becomes this major revue producer, writes the score to a show called So Long, Letty. This predates the official jazz designation, but there are suggestions that it is a contemporary score in terms of its feel and some of the instrumentation. There's a show called Sunny, which had a little bit of jazz element. And then revue, of course, because of the nature of revue, was a major home to jazz early on. So there were a number of early shows. I think the annual revue most closely associated with jazz was and remains George White's Scandals, because George Gershwin was involved with that show. You were talking about there's a theme or sort of an atmosphere to each of the revues. The atmosphere of George White's Scandals was very much contemporary jazz. That's why I would say that is probably the annual revue most closely associated with jazz.
And just to make sure everybody understands, we're not saying that Shuffle Along was not hugely important in popularizing it. Just the fact that it ran so long and was such a sensation, you could not get a ticket. It may be the most important thing in terms of bringing jazz to Broadway, but it's not the first.
It's not the first. I don't know if I personally would say the most important thing. It is a landmark show, and there are so many incredible things about that show, so momentous. I think what frustrates me and why I try to debunk the myths around it is that over the years, the lore around it has been so inflated. It stands on its own as a landmark work. So there's not really a need to sort of add these extra things which are just false. But it was a hugely influential piece. But in terms of the point about jazz musicians, you have folks like James Reese Europe, who was hugely influential in pushing forward jazz and also black musicians. And around the time of his death, which was 1919, there were on Broadway, I discovered, a number of black bands performing on the legitimate Broadway stage. They would do special concerts on Sunday, or there would be some sort of week-long engagement. There was a momentum going into Shuffle Along, I think, which is often left out of the conversation.
Absolutely. It's part of what made it pop so much. It had been primed to have this sort of success in some way. So let's talk about some of these other nightclubs during this period. So now we're in this intensification period. How did the nightclubs figure into that intensification? I assume you mean by intensification, shows are starting to get better.
Get better. Yes. Yes. That's the crude way to say it. Yes. I mean, nightclubs are, first of one, an incubator for talent, both on stage and off. Two, shaping sound. So when we're talking about, we just mentioned Shuffle Along, let's stay on black artists for just a moment. The nightclub really becomes an engine for black entertainment. And when we get to this intensification period, there are a number of black shows, most polished and proficient and successful black shows on the legitimate stage are actually transplants from nightclubs. Hot Chocolates, for example, that's a show that I think some people are familiar with. This had a score by Harry Brooks, Fats Waller, and Andy Razaf. This comes from a floor show in Harlem at Connie's Inn. And then, of course, the most iconic is the Blackbird series. And this comes out of a floor show called Blackbirds of 1925 at the Plantation, which was the second floor Schubert nightclub. Not operated by the Schuberts, to be clear, but they owned the real estate, effectively. And there were a number of shows that came out of the Plantation. And so nightclubs play a huge factor in terms of the sound of shows, the movement of shows in nightclubs and legit, black talent in particular. But it's not exclusive to this type of hot jazz environment, which I write about a little bit. Lou Brown and Sidney Clare had a hugely popular nightclub called the Melody Club, where it was about comedy. It was about sharper comedy, satirical comedy, witty comedy. Also on the comedy front, separately, you have Lou Clayton, Jimmy Durante, and Eddie Jackson, three crazy clowns. towns who had their own brand of nightclub entertainment. Again, this is in the second half of the 1920s. They will eventually go into, actually will stay on the Schubert nightclub. They go into the second floor nightclub. At that time, it's called L'Ambassadeur. Well, the Rendezvous first, and then L'Ambassadeur. They're both times, I believe. And then in 1929, the show that they do there has Ethel Merman. Of course, this is a year before she does Girl Crazy. Nightclubs are just a major force during this particular period on virtually all fronts, or influencing virtually all fronts. I just find them deeply exciting, I will say, on a personal note.
Absolutely. And all the creators of legitimate Broadway musicals are sitting in those nightclubs or going to those nightclubs after their show, or performing in those nightclubs after they leave the stage from their legit show.
There's a crossover. Yeah, yeah.
So it's all mixed up together. It's a bubbling cauldron of all this creativity that's going on.
As we mentioned earlier, just to reinforce, the nightclub at this particular time was largely theatrical in nature. We're talking about proper reviews in nightclubs. There are some clubs that are an individual performer. There's just a band playing for dancing. That existed. But by and large, the nightclubs we're talking about and the most prominent were these nightclubs of a theatrical nature.
You hinted at this earlier. The review changes now in this period to what starts to be called the intimate review, although they still had 50 people in them. So how intimate could it be? Why did it get that name? What was different about these intimate reviews from the annual reviews?
They were focused more on material and innovative stagecraft than on elaborate stage pictures, I would say. This is not to dismiss elaborate stage pictures or women, and certainly Ziegfeld in particular were iconic at the time. And actually he and his directors, Julian Mitchell, Ned Wayburn, Leon Errol, were utilizing inventive stagecraft. By the time we get to the 20s, though, there is, I think, an exhaustion of the lavishness that is happening. And so there is this turn throughout the 20s, actually, and this is something that happens toward the end of the period we had previously discussed, Birth of an Art Form, early 20s, there starts to be this turn alongside jazz toward sharper material, more refined dialogue, more refined lyrics, a greater deal of cleverness, ingenuity, character, satire, comment. And so this really bursts forth in the late 20s.
Don't go away. Ben and I will burst forth with more Broadway Nation right after this quick break.
Dancing in the dark till the tune ends. We're dancing in the dark and it soon ends. We're waltzing in the wonder of why we're here. Time hurries by.
Hi, this is David Armstrong, and even here in Seattle, warmer, sunnier days are on their way. So it's time to fuel up for them and meet your wellness goals with Factor's No Prep, No Mess meals. Thanks to Factor's menu of chef-crafted meals with options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, or my favorite, Vegetarian, Factor's fresh, never-frozen meals are dietitian-approved and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. So no matter how busy you are, you'll always have time to enjoy nutritious, great-tasting meals. So what are you waiting for? Kickstart that new healthy routine with 35 different meals and more than 60 add-ons to choose from every week, so you'll always have new flavors to explore. And you can crush those wellness goals with dietitian-approved meals and ingredients that you can trust. Make every day delicious from breakfast to dessert with restaurant-quality meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, and blackened salmon, with no shopping, prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. With Factor, you enjoy effortless support for your lifestyle, choosing from 6 menu preferences that help you manage calories, maximize protein intake, avoid meat, or simply eat well-balanced meals. Here's what you do. Head to factormeals.com/BN50 and use code BN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month. That's code BN50 at factormeals.com/BN50, as in Broadway Nation 50, and you'll get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next month while your subscription is active. Do it today.
And we can face the music together. Dancing in the dark.
And so there is satire, there's social comment, political comment, sharp lyrics, the idea of an elevated lyric writing and more complex musical figures. Revue is really the epicenter of this move toward more sophisticated songwriting, sophisticated sketch writing, integration of staging and story. From what we would think today, they were still comparatively large compared to today's more intimate shows, but they were more intimate compared to the annuals that had previously dominated the scene. And they were really incredible, especially Howard Dietz I talk about a great deal because he's an extraordinary showman, excellent lyricist, one of the individuals that really is pushing toward complex writing, complex narrative structure and lyric writing, use of language, sophisticated use of language. But also in his creation of reviews, there was, as you alluded to, this distinct style to each of his reviews. There was a cohesive character to his reviews, even if there was not a theme, a specific theme, as one found, for example, in As Thousands Cheer, which is a Moss Hart Irving Berlin show about headlines, or based on newspaper headlines. I said that very casually. I don't mean to dismiss it. It's a landmark show, but...
Which of these shows most interests you of these intimate reviews? And certainly that Irving Berlin Moss Hart show was very much part of this.
Sophisticated idea, yeah. Something that deeply interests me, which I address, is a show called The Comic Supplement, which is a J.P. McAvoy review that did not make it to New York, which is actually an early instance of non-traditional storytelling. Review becomes a central component in non-traditional storytelling in the 60s when one starts talking about Stephen Sondheim, Harold Prince, etc. Review was a central component, and this is an early instance of that in that it is a review. So it is episodic in nature. There's not a specific plot that is happening, but it centers around one typical American family, and you see them over the course of a number of years in everyday circumstances. So the daughter, which was played by Ray Dooley, who's a major female comedian at the time, she begins the show as a little baby, and she ends the show dancing in a cabaret. So this gives you an idea. So that is fascinating. And I'll just go back to Howard Dietz, though, because I find him to be extraordinary, and I think The Little Show is an exquisite piece of theater, the way that it's routine, how calculated it is, the quality of all of the material, and the way it is put together, the ideas that it has. And it was a game changer in terms of the trajectory of revue. Three's a Crowd as well. That's another Howard Dietz. That's 1930. That's his first show with Hazard Short, who is a major force in terms of utilizing lighting and staging to amplify story. He starts doing this in terms of the musical in vaudeville, actually, in vaudeville taps. Then he's associated with Irving Berlin's Music Box Review. And then in 1930, he's with Howard Dietz doing Three's a Crowd. And then, interestingly, the show that I think most people who know Revue remember is The Bandwagon, because it was a major hit. It was really an extraordinary production. I think what's especially interesting about that show is that if you drill down, it is the production and the conceit that is carrying the day. The material itself is actually somewhat uneven, particularly given it's Howard Dietz, George S. Kaufman. The music is fairly consistently excellent across the board. That's Arthur Schwartz. But the material is weaker than Dietz's two prior reviews that he owned. There was another review in there. That's why I say he owned. The second Little Show was not really a deep-driven piece. He and Schwartz contributed several songs, though. So anyway, The Bandwagon is an interesting piece because it was conceived by Dietz to be played on a double turntable. Hamilton, for anyone listening, is played on a double turntable.
And by that, you mean a turntable inside a turntable.
Correct, correct. So Dietz specifically conceived this review to be played on a double turntable. This is the brilliance of the review, is that conceit, and then the material was specifically sculpted for that physical environment, for the double turntables, and for the specific personalities of the cast. So it was this extraordinarily cohesive affair, extraordinarily modern stagecraft. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Again, though, if you drill down and you just take the material out of the show and look at the sketch, or you're reading a sketch or looking at a song, most of them don't rise to the level of George Kaufman or Howard Dietz, incidentally. But it is, again, the cohesive whole that I think enraptured audiences.
Let's also talk about what's happening in the musical comedies of this time, the story-driven shows. These things are obviously all influenced by each other as well. The reviews are influencing the musical comedies and vice versa. But what's the essence of this period we're talking, again, 1925 to 1930? What are we seeing in the musical comedies that's...
Well, I break them down into two categories. It's not so distinct, but in terms of clarity and structure purposes, there are the shows blues that people think of when they think of 1920s in terms of sunny, syncopated, carefree college football games on the stage. And so you have those shows like the Brown De Silva and Henderson shows, Good News, for example, Follow Through. Their musical comedies were 1927 through 1930. They had a number of shows during that period.
We've always thought knowledge is not, we should be taught to dance right here at 8. We're up to date. We teach a grade new dance. Don't think that I brag. I speak of the drag. Why should a sheep learn how to speak Latin and Greek badly? Give him a neat motto complete. Say it with feet gladly. First lesson right now. You'll love it and how you love it. Here is the drag. See how it goes. Down on the heels, up on the toes. That's the way to do the varsity drag. Dirty old low, no hotter than hot. Newer than new, meaner than mean. Bluer than blue. Gets as much applause as waving a flag. You can pass many a class, whether you're dumb or wise, if you all answer the call when your professor cries. Everybody down on the heels, up on the toes, stay after school and learn how it goes. Everybody do the varsity drag.
Sort of one hit after another.
Oh, yes, hugely successful. I don't mean to minimize them. Yes, they were hugely successful and quite exciting. The way in which I'm talking about them in terms of the categories is a lot of these shows are written by writers primarily associated with popular songwriting. And again, popular songwriting at this time overlaps with the musical stage. So you have the Brown De Silva Henderson shows, hugely successful. Some of the Ziegfeld shows like Whoopi, Eddie Cantor show, Eddie Dowling, I mentioned a couple of his shows actually, which are in this sort of sunny syncopated line. And he deliberately was not interested in proper character development. And he speaks about this. I don't mean to put this on him. He was not interested in sculpting a clearly defined arc for a certain character. He liked the characters to find themselves and speak for themselves. I don't want to bastardize what he's saying. There is an interview where he speaks about this, which is more articulate than what I'm saying, so I don't want to put words in his mouth. But incidentally, just as a little asterisk, he then will do later on Time of Your Life, Glass Menagerie, Iceman Cometh, so there is a transition that happened. But nonetheless, so there's that sort of brand of 1920s musical comedy that I think is what people most often think of when they think of 1920s, but that is not all that was happening. That is one of the points that I make in the book, that it's not just this sort of carefree confection with pop songs. There are other shows that are happening. Burt Kalmar and Harry Ruby, for example, write a handful of clown shows, which are, to be fair, ephemeral. This is not the soundly constructed work that someone's going to pick up and do today, but there are dramaturgical techniques or certain things that are happening in the shows they're creating, which will pave the way for something like Forum or something like Top Banana, Guys and Dolls, when we get into this period of maturity. Who else? The Gershwins, for example, are aiming for a more integrated type of work, particularly in the song element or the music department of their shows. And then Lorenz Hart, Richard Rodgers, and specifically Herbert Fields. Hart and Rodgers, as you know, write a number of shows. I focus in particular on the ones with Herbert Fields because those tend to be the most adventurous and pioneering in terms of their dramaturgical construct.
Go into that just a little more, because I think Herbert Fields is somebody I love to highlight as well. He's so important, and yet most people do not know his name.
Yeah.
He comes from a legendary family, and he's involved not only from the 20s into the 50s, into the 60s.
Yeah.
He has a major Broadway career, and yet he's sort of fallen out of, he's not name-checked almost anywhere. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Herbert Fields, major librettist, particularly in the 20s. And if I can posit a reason for his disappearance, as you described, I think it is because he's one of the individuals who is revolutionary in the 20s, but who doesn't necessarily continue to progress with the times. For example, some of his later shows are, I think he does 3 or 4 with Cole Porter. Something for the Boys is one of them. He does the book with his sister, Dorothy Fields, for Annie Get Your Gun. So in any case, in the 20s, though, in particular, he's working with Lorenz Hart, Richard Rodgers, Vincent Humans, quite an innovative librettist for this particular period. The show that I focus on in the book in particular is Peggy Ann, which also has its own lineage because it's produced by Lou Fields. It's based on a Lou Fields musical from the early teens. And of course, Lou Fields is sort of king of legitimate burlesque turn of the 20th century with his then partner, Joe Weber. Interesting in terms of Herbert Fields in particular, in terms of dialogue, construction, crafting character, integrating certain elements. Peggy Ann is really an interesting show just for how it's put together, the way it's composed. It takes place primarily in a series of dream sequences. An adventurous and forward-thinking, modern-minded librettist in the way that he, Herbert Fields, is working in this particular era. I don't think, again, that translates when we get into the 30s and 40s. There are people who are moving beyond him in terms of sound dramaturgical construction, but he's certainly one of the engines that is driving this intensification in the late 20s.
Where we're headed next is the musical play. Your final section of this chapter is Oscar Hammerstein II and the musical play. So I think it's an appropriate time to leave that for the next episode because things are going to change dramatically. It's interesting always to think about what would have happened if the Depression hadn't happened. Would Showboat have had more immediate impact than it was allowed to?
Interesting.
I don't know.
It had been open for a year, you know, 2 years, actually. I mean, because Crash is late 29.
Or was it, I hate to use the word ahead of its time, but was it so its own thing? The other writers didn't think, well, we should do that too. They were happy with what they were doing. It's a very interesting to try to get in the minds of the writers that period. And then I think once you get to the stock market crash, everything's up for grabs.
I don't know. I don't think there was a stop in this push toward more refined, cohesive storytelling that Showboat embodies, because Hammerstein himself continues to do that, in particular with the show I discuss in the book Rainbow. It doesn't come together in the way that Showboat does. Vincent Humans is perhaps not the dramatic composer, a brilliant composer, extraordinary, by the way, let me just say across the board, exceptional composer. However, the score for Rainbow is not deeply substantial, and one wonders if he did not have the dramatic or dramaturgical weight for that show. I mean, that's not the only thing to mention about that particular show, but I don't know. I think Showboat was definitely sort of a revolution and perhaps an anomaly. I think it had an influence. I think it was also people continuing to find their way, and how do we execute that?
And I think you make a very good point also that if Rainbow had been successful, two shows back to back doing this new thing, the way we eventually had Oklahoma and then
Little Girl and Carousel and
exactly.
Yeah.
So that's a lot to talk about when we come back. Ben West, it has been fabulous to have you here today on Broadway Nation to talk about your new book, The American Musical.
Thank you for having me. Great to speak with you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Now here's the information about how you too can become a patron of Broadway Nation. A donation of just $7 a month will not only keep Broadway Nation rolling along, it will also provide you with exclusive access to the complete unedited versions of many of the interviews that you hear on this podcast. And all patrons will receive special shout-outs and acknowledgments of your vital support for Broadway Nation. To join, simply go to broadwaynationpodcast.supercast.tech. That's broadwaynationpodcast.supercast.tech. Or click the link in the show notes to this episode. Broadway Nation is written and produced by me, David Armstrong. Special thanks to Pals Mox for his help with editing this episode, and to the entire team at the Broadway Podcast Network.
Wondered how your favorite performer actually feels? Well, here's your chance. Welcome to The Quiet Part Out Loud with me, Bobby Steggert, Broadway actor and now a therapist to a whole host of Broadway creatives. Part interview, part therapy, this is not your typical podcast. We'll go right to the heart of things with some of your favorite artists, what they still struggle with, what lessons they've learned, what they haven't figured out yet. There's enormous power in saying the quiet part out loud. Are you listening?
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.